Hello, welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast. I'm your host, Ian T.D. Thompson. The Positive Energy Podcast is the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. The initiative seeks to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. Today on the program, we are talking with Michael Cleland, who is Senior Fellow with the Positive Energy Project, Chair of the Board of Directors at the Canadian Energy Research Institute, and a member of the Board of Directors of Quest. Earlier this month, Mr. Cleland co-authored an article for the Energy Regulation Quarterly entitled Canada's Energy Future in an Age of Climate Change, Public Confidence, and Institutional Foundations for Change. The article can be viewed as an extension of his work published in March of this year, with a focus on the significance of language and the important role of our institutions and need for thoughtful innovation. Mr. Cleland joins us on phone from Ottawa to talk more about the report. Mr. Cleland, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
The article observes that a good place to start with Canadian climate policy would be to learn from Canada's history. What does history over the last 30 years tell us about Canadian climate change policy?
Well, I guess start with the facts. I mean, the facts are that over 30 years, we've achieved very little in terms of dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. But on the other side of it, as it looks to me, and I think our research shows that, is that we've seen a steady loss of both consumer and investor confidence. So it's been, in many ways, the worst of both worlds. But as to why, are there any number of reasons? I'll give you a few. One is I think the policy has been marked by what I'll call wishful thinking over a realistic assessment of what we were trying to do. Secondly, I would say that a pretty steady stream of decision makers misleading people as to exactly what it all means. And then maybe the most important is that it's been built on a misunderstanding of the energy system and what it is that Canadians are looking for from their energy system. So those three things, we go back and look at that and say, okay, well, how do we look at it going forward? Maybe if we keep those things in mind, it'll help.
So within the context of those issues and what we've learned from history, is Canada's consistent underperformance with international climate change agreements? You think of Rio, Kyoto, Copenhagen, and the most recent one being the Paris Accord. What should we make of these large, long-term policy targets? How should we kind of view them in relation to this decline in public confidence and trust in energy decision-making?
Well, that's one where I would say that there's nothing wrong with having long-term or even, if that matter, medium-term targets. You have to have something to aim at. But one of the problems I think we've seen is that targets have tended to become kind of the holy grail. And in many cases for political leaders of various sorts, they become substitutes for actual action. So I would say, yeah, okay, you've got to have those objectives, but then let's focus on what it is we actually need to do.
Mm-hmm. One of the lessons over the last 30 years is the need to include economic imperatives when addressing energy policy. You note investor confidence has become undercut by social opposition to energy infrastructure projects. Can you expand on this point and discuss the role that affordability and investor confidence play in addressing climate policy?
Well, start with affordability, and I think this is one where, you know, again, the work we've done at Positive Energy strongly reinforces this, but so does all of the other evidence that's out there, is that whatever it is that Canadians may say about what they would like to do about climate change, when they're put to it, what will matter to them first and foremost will be affordability. And we have to be thinking about how we work that into the approach we take. And I would add to that not only affordability, but also the basic functioning of the energy system. So pretty critical part of the puzzle and one of the reasons why we haven't made a lot of progress. As to investor confidence, I would say a number of things. I mean, one obviously is increasingly a slow and very uncertain approval process for most kinds of projects, and I'm not just talking about pipelines here. I think we're talking about all sorts of capital projects. Policy that is volatile, that swings back and forth, especially as governments change, and a number of places where it is perfectly obvious that the policy being put forward, at least by some political actors, is clearly unrealistic. Can't be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. There's a real dismissal of investors in one side and the stability that they might need for a large-scale infrastructure project.
Well, yeah, and the simple practicality of getting these things done. I mean, you know, we know, for example, we talk about the 2030 target, and yet anyone who actually does these things and has ever seen a capital project being dealt with in the last couple of decades. For example, if you wanted to do a big new electricity project, I mean, I'm talking about really big scale here, from planning to having it in service is probably more than a decade. So we're already past 2030 in terms of actually getting anything done. And we're going to need investors to believe that we're serious about this.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting point, considering, as you mentioned, people are ignoring the realism of it. They're constantly just thinking that, again, that wishful thinking that we're able to reach those targets no matter what. And the truth is that we might not be able to. The affordability is a quite interesting one, considering you have jurisdictions like Ontario, which saw a huge issue with their affordability of their prices when they made a big significant shift to completely renewables, cutting out the coal plants and everything. So it's quite interesting to see it from a provincial perspective, that issue of affordability.
Yeah, and it extends everywhere. The other really interesting example, of course, is in the Lower Mainland of BC, where they object to the idea of new pipelines or oil shipments in Vancouver Harbour and George Strait. But they also object vociferously to the idea of higher gasoline prices. So as I say, when put to it, individual people, and that's all of us, will tend to look to those immediate concerns.
Again, for me, that's quite interesting that the human nature of things wants both this and that, and you can't. There's got to be a compromise ultimately.
Yeah, there does, and there are no bad guys here. There are ordinary human beings acting like ordinary human beings.
Oh, so I want to switch directions a little bit. So this article, in its title, it talks about the importance of language. It addresses the role of language, terminology, vocabulary, and framing, and how vital that language is to adequately debating and discussing climate and energy policy. Can you describe to listeners how vocabulary might hinder climate and energy debate?
Well, there are, I guess, a number of ways, and the most obvious one, and it comes up in the context of discussions about polarization, all that kind of thing, is when language is accusatory or dismissive of people and their concerns or treats people as bad guys or simply people who don't get it. That's one thing. But the other side of that, though, is a language that is so vague and ambiguous that it masks real differences. And an obvious one that we've been working with, doing some work on at Positive Energy, is the term transition, where it's not overstating it to say that that there are almost as many definitions of the term as there are users. So we flogged this language. We're talking to each other, but we're not actually saying anything to each other. And that comes up in the political context with all sorts of virtue signaling. People say, oh, yeah, I believe in this, but they don't really mean it. And maybe another one would be language that raises unrealistic expectations, that leaves people thinking, okay, yeah, this is going to be it. My community is going to be able to say no or have a veto over this or that project, and we all know that that's not a practical option.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned where people are kind of hiding behind a certain word, they're kind of masking the real differences. And in this article, you observe a term coined by Henry Kissinger called constructive ambiguity. And I was just hoping maybe you could just kind of expand on this point a little bit, just because I find that to be a rather interesting concept.
Well, it is, and I'm sure that Kissinger had an interesting insight when he did coin that in international relations. And we all know this, that you know, step one is obviously getting people to come to the table and say, okay, look, you know, can we agree generally on where we're trying to go here, and then dig into it as you develop relationships and all that kind of thing. And so that's where I think ambiguity can be constructive. The problem is that if it doesn't go beyond that, if you don't peel that back and say, okay, well, what is it we're really talking about, then all it is a way of just kicking the can down the road and never getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of keeping the parties as happy for as long as possible without getting into the narrow, fine details.
Well, and if you can kick the can far enough down the road, then it becomes somebody else's problem.
Well, that's a very real consideration when some of these politicians might only be in power for the short term. So
well, that could be
So there's two other terms I kind of want to discuss with you. The first one is the word clean and the concept of clean energy. And this is a word that's growing increasingly tied to new environmental and energy policy initiatives. I think of just how many might be influencing the way that think tanks present their work, or even how government branches might title the name of their branch or their unit. So I'm just curious, how might this word be viewed as problematic in climate and energy conversation, especially as it is becoming a little bit more institutionalized?
I guess I would say that this is again one of those ones that is ambiguous without being particularly constructive, because it'll mean what people want it to mean. You know, if I'm in a local community, clean is going to mean that you're not polluting my local water supplies or my air quality. And for someone preoccupied with greenhouse gas emissions, clean necessarily means reduced greenhouse gas emissions. And they can be aligned. They can be made to work together. But they mean different things. And again, for most people in local communities, what most matters is the impact on the local community. So clean is going to vary depending on where you actually sit.
Mm. Yeah, so that again, coming back to that ambiguity, that seems to be the issue with it, rather than kind of defining this is what exactly clean should represent.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with the term. What's missing is then the question that necessarily follows, which is, what do you mean by clean? What are we actually talking about here?
Mm-hmm. Rather than just saying we support clean energy.
Yeah, which is a meaningless statement, really.
One of the phrases heard throughout this year and throughout the past election is climate crisis. And again, early this year, the House of Commons passed a motion observing the national climate emergency and that climate change is a real and urgent crisis. How might the use of climate crisis help or hinder addressing climate policy, especially in this discussion about language?
It can arguably help if it focuses people's minds on what we actually have to do. It can help, I think, if people understand that, you know, assuming that the climate is changing, and certainly the science seems to indicate that at the pace that it may be changing, that we're going to have a crisis, I'll use the term advisedly here, of adaptation to deal with all those effects. On the other side, and I would say that on balance, the term is actually negative in terms of dealing with the issue. It is one of those virtue signaling kinds of terms that, now we've passed a resolution saying it's a crisis, now get back to business as usual. But it's worse than that, because I think what it says is that if somebody's a pragmatist, somebody who says, look, you know, we've got to come at this systematically in a measured way, that may be wrong or it may be right, but there are still people there, people who want progress, but they end up being somehow vilified as, don't you understand, this is a crisis. Getting worse, and I've many years working in public policy, I've seen this up close, is that you have governments who are, by virtue of these kinds of terms, are spurred to, well, we've got to do something really fast, when what they really should be doing is thinking about what they're doing and what are the implications. And, okay, we need to move quickly, but the actual getting it done is going to take decades. Mm-hmm. And the word crisis doesn't help very much in that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of that rushing an urgency aspect.
Which is rushing to make all sorts of really bad mistakes.
Should we be describing the issues of climate change in another way rather than describing it as a crisis?
Very good question. I'm not sure that I have an answer to that. It's kind of academic sounding, but I would call it a kind of a fundamental public policy issue that we need to take very, very seriously and be thinking about what are the serious long-term actions that are necessary to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier just to say crisis.
In this article, you observe that science and engineering and economics have been the two disciplines dominating energy and climate debate over the last 30 years. What are the problems in having these two disciplines dominating the debate, and why are they not sufficient, and what do they kind of miss?
Yeah, and I guess I would say the problem there is what's missing. So start with science, you know, and you can say, well, the science of climate change, and that's pretty basic in terms of what it is we need to do. Extends from there into thinking about technology, and people like to talk about technology and use the word. It always sounds kind of fashionable. But it begs a lot of questions about how the technology actually gets deployed, which then brings you into thinking about, well, what is the economic feasibility of it? all good so far, except that that leaves you with a lot of questions about what it is that human beings actually do in practice and how it affects their behavior. So there are a lot of other disciplines that that need to be brought into the picture and become part of what defines realistic policy.
And what might those other disciplines be exactly? Which disciplines need to be included in this policy discussion on climate change?
Well, some obvious ones would be sociology, political science, more applied disciplines like public administration. Another one where I work actively with some other colleagues and other organizations is with respect to urban planning. And then communications. Those are all applied disciplines. And a lot of them, maybe with the exception of communications, have been missing from the forefront of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. And how might decision makers be able to include these other disciplines a little bit more easily in the debate?
It gets complicated by virtue of the fact that if you do things that are kind of quantitative and mathematical and all that kind of thing, and it kicks out a single number or a single fairly simplified direction, that works a lot better on Twitter. That works a lot better in a public or political debate. So what we need is forums where people have the patience to say, okay, yeah, but when you're dealing with real people, it gets more complicated and it's more subtle. So part of it is getting away from, you know, what I'll call Twitter world.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Just, again, the idea that maybe we need more time to figure this out rather than here's the answer in 150 characters or less.
Well, that's right. And spend some time listening to each other and questioning each other as to what it is we're actually saying and what we mean.
The article explores the role of institutions and how might institutions evolve to address climate policy and ultimately where decision-making authority should rest. That's the penultimate question. Several institutions have evolved over time to have greater importance over climate and energy policy, particularly at the local level. And those two local entities are the indigenous communities as well as the municipalities themselves. And you mentioned the need to include more urban planning in the discussion. My question is, how critical are these institutions' roles in energy decision making?
We'll start with the fact that about half of our energy use and half of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the local level, come from our needs in individual communities. So, you know, just in themselves as entities, they're pretty important. But maybe a couple of slightly different but equally important aspects here is the first one being that local communities are increasingly insisting that they have a say. And they're insisting with some success. People say, okay, yeah, we have to give them a say. And that's probably going to grow over time. And we're going to need to learn how the institutions can better accommodate that. And for that matter, how they as local communities can learn about their circumstances and how they can be constructive participants. The other side of it is the extent to which there are all sorts of possible solutions to be found at the local level. It starts with energy efficiency, pretty straightforward, except that it's not. There's all sorts of complications. It goes on to how do you use local waste, how do you use local renewable sources, and how does the community organize itself to do that. It's the same thing whether it's municipal governments or indigenous governments. Obviously, indigenous governments operate in a world where they have different legal rights, but they're dealing with basically the same thing.
And again, it's quite interesting you mentioned the idea that there are genuine climate issues that municipalities and indigenous communities can't directly address, such as waste management being one of them. And one of the aspects that always I think of when I think of municipalities is the aspect that most municipalities, if not all municipalities in Canada, cannot run a deficit. So they can't make those large-scale investments that we might be able to see at the provincial and federal level. It's interesting to see that they are both gaining importance in this energy policy debate, but there are real institutional challenges that they might face down the line just by them being a municipality and them not being able to run a deficit.
Well, that's an important one, and one that can be helped out, obviously, by provincial governments or the federal government assisting them financially. But maybe the more important one is the basic capacity to do it. Typically, local governments don't have the capacity to readily understand their energy circumstances or to be thinking through what makes sense and what doesn't. And they're learning. They're coming along. Local energy planning is becoming mainstream. And they're developing the institutional capability to do it. But that's going to take time, and it's going to take assistance from other governments.
I guess with that kind of that frame in mind and knowing that this is a growing aspect for these local institutions, how might decision makers at the higher levels, both at the federal level as well as the provincial level, what are the aspects that they need to consider in observing these growing roles of these local actors and the challenges that they may face that are unique to them?
I would say the key one here is a bit of a balancing act. You know, on the one hand, I think it's potentially very constructive for local authorities and to have a bigger say, take on more of the responsibility. On the other hand, we also have big infrastructure that needs to be built, big projects, decisions that will need to be taken from a national or a provincial perspective. And inevitably, that's going to override some local concerns. And so that's the critical one, is continuing to look for that balance.
Outside of these local institutions, you also refer to other institutions that play a role in this discussion. One is the role of non-governmental organizations, think tanks, associations, and activist groups that play a role in these energy projects and climate policy as a whole. How might NGOs constructively contribute to the discussion? Conversely, how might they diminish the debate?
Maybe this answers both sides of that question. I would say the more that what I'll call civil society can stop contributing to the shouting match, the better off we'll be. And we know this because some of the work we're doing, well, in fact, basic work we're doing at Positive Energy is about convening people to come together and have serious discussions, respectful discussions about where the real solutions may lie. So less shouting, more reasonable discourse and dialogue. And maybe I'm a bit naive here, but I'd like to think that the more we can get that sort of thing going and bring it into the public domain, maybe that'll help to create some space where the political actors can find compromise. Mm-hmm. Again, maybe that's naive, but that's how it's worked in the past, and maybe it can work that way again.
Mm-hmm. So on top of the NGOs and the local levels, we get to the all-important role of the actual regulators themselves. And they've been at kind of the forefront of this discussion for a while now, as often the regulators go through large-scale reform, both provincially and federally, and they've been undergoing that kind of reform over the years. What are the key questions that need to be addressed in terms of the role of regulators in energy and climate policy?
Start with the basic thing that regulators, or things that regulators do, and probably most people don't have a really close understanding of that, but putting it simply, they are the bodies that provide, or you know, give approval to big projects to allow them to go forward and set the conditions under which they go forward. So when you think about somebody regulating pipelines, that's where that comes in. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it is again getting back to the local level, where a lot of energy delivery is through what we call natural monopoly systems, utilities, pipes and wires at the local level. And regulators oversee that. They determine prices, and they determine what the ultimate shape of those systems is going to be by virtue of the structures that they work with. So lots of innovation needed there across the board, and the regulators are onto it, but the circumstances under which they work make it difficult for them.
Yes, by their nature as agencies of government, are often roped into the politics of it. With that in mind, are regulators the ultimate deciders of policy, or are they merely advisors to political decision makers?
And that may be the nub of what we're going to be doing at Positive Energy over the next year, because that is really the critical question. The way that we typically thought about regulators in Canada in the last several decades is that they are experts and they make the decision based on their expertise. They are gatherers of evidence in a systematic way. And the way they operate is through processes or due process that allows people access to the decision system. And for the most part, their decisions are relatively technical. And arguably, those sorts of decisions should be made by bodies that are independent, ultimately politically accountable in some way, because they operate under legislative and frameworks and regulations that are set by governments. But the both the process and the substance of their work is something that that lends itself to acting more independently.
Mm-hmm. Again, that key question of what is their role moving forward. As you said, that will be an interesting question that will expand over time. That leads nicely into my next question. What are the next steps or important questions that need to be addressed in your work or the work that you're engaged with at Positive Energy?
Well, maybe I'll come back to the point about we were talking earlier on about, you know, crisis, and let's get away from that word. But what I would say, and I think most people would agree, is that we need to act urgently. But that I would say the decision makers, probably the most urgent task in front of us is to be thinking about these decision processes. Who decides and how do they decide under what circumstances? And how do you, at one and the same time, promote innovation, but also while protecting health and safety and system reliability and all of those other things that we count on? Those are complex questions. And ones that decision makers, I don't think, are paying enough attention to.
Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what they need to be examining a little bit more.
Yeah, it's really easy to kind of say, well, look, we just need some more widgets of one sort or another. And I've actually heard a long time ago some political figures using that those sorts of terms. This other stuff isn't very appealing or and it's complex, but it's where we need to be turning our minds.
I have a few more questions, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about the recent Canadian federal election and what we saw as kind of an increasing regional divide and the return or I guess the more noticeable along the political seat line of Western alienation. What are your thoughts on this divide, especially as we move forward with Canadian energy decision making?
Well, in terms of the regional divide, one of the things that continues to puzzle me as I look at the Canadian climate debate, it seems odd to think we have a country here who, you know, whose debate on this subject is almost deliberately aimed at increasing the alienation of one part of the country from the other, even though the effect of that will be at best minimal in terms of actually solving the climate problem. I don't get that. I do get it in terms of communication and spin and all that, but not in terms of substance. So it takes you back to the question of, you know, can we get a more civil conversation going here that looks over the next 30 years and what we're actually going to achieve? But the other part of that I don't think people are paying enough attention to is that it isn't just a regional divide. It's also I'll call it a kind of urban versus rural resource economy divide. And if you look at the electoral map, I think if you look at it closely enough, that shows up pretty clearly. And maybe that's a more worrisome divide in some ways than the regional one.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting observation, observing who voted for what party and who has ultimately the resources in that geography. That'll be an interesting question moving forward, especially when you observe who ultimately decides on the policies affecting those resources.
Well, yeah, and I mean, a good example is, you know, people say, well, you know, BC or British Columbians think one thing and Albertans think another. But if you get yourself up into kind of northeastern BC where they have a resource economy, I suspect you'll find that a lot of the people up that way think a lot more like Albertans than they do like people in the lower mainland of BC.
Mm-hmm. Michael, I don't have any more questions, but I was curious, are there any additional comments or thoughts you would like to add regarding your article or anything else about the work that you do with Positive Energy?
I guess maybe on a, I like to think, more positive note, again, from the work that we're doing at Positive Energy, one of the things we have a pretty good idea of is that most stakeholders, and by that I mean right across the spectrum, environmental groups, indigenous groups, industry groups, et cetera, et cetera. But most stakeholders actually get all this. They understand that we need to have a different sort of conversation, that there are different ways of getting at it. They understand that we need to get at the institutions. But a lot of the incentive in the public sphere is to continue having the shouting matches. And that gets in the way of those more serious conversations. So a lot of us, I think, and again, I include a lot of these stakeholders in this, realize that we have to have some quieter conversations behind the scenes that that actually get at it. And I don't think that's impossible.
That's a great positive way to look at it, is to say that in the midst of this crisis, that there is some positivity, that there are stakeholders, important stakeholders, that ultimately get that we can't just yell at people.
Well, yeah, and if it's not that, then you have to say, okay, well, what's the alternative? And I would argue that the alternative isn't actually solving the problem, but probably generating more paralysis. And I don't see what I fail to see what could be the possible benefit to anybody from that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the article, and we look forward to your continuing work with Positive Energy.
Okay, well, thank you, Ian. Appreciate it.
You have been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. Today's episode was produced, hosted, and edited by myself, Ian T.D. Thompson.